Over 50 years ago, when I was just a year old, a British band called the Rolling Stones released a song that said, "I can't get no satisfaction." Some of you even finished the title to the song. And that song over the years has been re-recorded over 50 times by other artists. But most people know the original cut. Even a generation that wasn't born yet still knows that song. It's continued to play on the airwaves today. It's been said that this song could have easily been the anthem of the 1960s, as people were trying everything to find satisfaction and they weren't getting it. They weren't finding it anywhere. Now, the Rolling Stones were not the first to put such a sentiment in poetic verse. Consider this little ditty from Ecclesiastes 1. "Meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." Now, if you kind of recognize those words but can't place the tune, relax. That wasn't a song that was ever played on American Bandstand. I don't know that it ever was put to music, but it is certainly written in poetic form. And it sounds an awful lot like Mick Jagger singing, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." As we continue our series this morning, What It Means to Be Human, I'd like to take one more week and consider the problem of sin. So far, we have seen how we were created in the image of light and likeness of God, that both as men and women, we share His image and likeness that gives us worth. He created us in a perfect environment and with a design in mind, but sin entered the picture. And sin has separated us from God, and sin has corrupted every part of our being, body, soul, and spirit. This morning, I'd like to see what sin has done to life itself. That life has been also affected by sin. And we're going to do so through the example that was read for us earlier out of Ecclesiastes, but we're also going to see how it works in our own lives. And you may have noticed there is an insert in your bulletin. There is a chart. We're going to go through this chart step by step. I would encourage you, if you've never done so before, on our church's website, there is a sermon archive. And you can download the printed text of the sermons, an audio version or video. It takes you to a link on YouTube where you can watch these messages if you ever miss a Sunday or if you want to go back and review. For this particular Sunday, if you download the text version, you will see this chart piece by piece as we go through. And I would encourage you to check that out. Solomon introduces a journey that he took in life. In the book of Ecclesiastes, our scripture reading was verses 1 through 11 in chapter 1. I'd like to pick it up in verse 12. Solomon writes, "I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind." There's two phrases here that allude to the same thing, and they're the key to the book. If you miss this, you will completely misunderstand the book of Ecclesiastes, and many people have. The phrase is, "under the sun." And its fellow phrase is "under heaven." "Under the sun" appears 29 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. "Under heaven" appears, I believe, 3 times. They both refer to the same concept, and that is without God. Okay? You have to have that in mind or you'll miss the whole point of the book of Ecclesiastes. I know many Christians that hate the book of Ecclesiastes because it's so negative, it's so depressing. You miss the point. Solomon is on an experiment here. And he has decided he is going to try to find meaning, purpose, fulfillment, satisfaction in life without God. That's the key. And Solomon had everything at his disposal to do it. Remember, when he first became king, God appeared before him and said, "I will give you anything you want." I know there's a lot of TV preachers that talk about God giving us a blank check and we can put in it what we want. He doesn't, but this is the only time in history he did. He told Solomon, "You say the word, I will give it to you." Solomon was still a young man at this point, a little bit intimidated by the task he had just inherited after the death of his father David. And so he requested for wisdom. He said, "I need wisdom to be able to lead these people." And God was so pleased, he was so impressed by Solomon's request that he said, "I'm going to give you everything you didn't ask for." You could have asked for long life. You could have asked for wealth. You could have asked for peace in your kingdom. He said, "I'm going to give it all to you. You're going to be the wealthiest man to ever live. You're going to be the wisest man to ever live. I'm going to grant you peace." By the way, Solomon in Hebrew is a form of shalom, which means peace. And God gave it all to Solomon. He lacked nothing. That's very important. Because as you go through this and you apply it today, and people are trying to find satisfaction or fulfillment in various avenues, and they might say, "Oh, but if I just had a little bit more. Oh, if I had had that opportunity." Trust me, Solomon had every opportunity. He had it all. And what we're going to find is, everything that he had and everything that he pursued and everything that he accomplished and achieved didn't satisfy. And Ecclesiastes is the journal of that journey. Chuck Swindoll calls it a midlife crisis. Maybe it was. You know how midlife crises go. You get to that point, you wake up one day and you say, here I am, 35, 40, 45, 50. And life is passing me by, and it's not what I thought it would be when I was 15 or 20. I need to go find myself. And you find people going out and buy a new sports car, they buy a boat, or they, you know, do whatever it is to try to be happy. And you kind of get that sense here. Maybe Solomon was going through it. And because he was king, he could have whatever he wanted. I mean, who's going to tell the king no? And he just went for it with unrestrained determination. He set out on a pursuit to find purpose in existence. I'd like to take a look at some of the things he did. In Ecclesiastes 1, verse 16, we're going to actually get into chapter 2. Solomon says, "I thought to myself, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone else who has ruled in Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. And I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief." Whoever coined the phrase "ignorant is bliss" would have gotten a hearty amen from Solomon. He went down the avenue of logic, of wisdom, of learning. That's where I'm going to find real purpose in life. We might say he became very philosophical. And what he determined was, it don't cut it. It doesn't make me any happier. It doesn't make me any more fulfilled. If anything, it leaves me more empty. So he tries another path. "I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good." He went down the avenue of leisure. And I don't think there is a society on earth that spends more time and money and energy on leisure than we do here in the United States of America. Entertainment is a multi-billion dollar business. Solomon went that route, and what did he say? That also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish, and what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. What he says here is, I never lost control. He wasn't going out getting wasted, so he couldn't remember what happened the next day. He was keeping his wits about him, but he really kind of pushed the envelope in these areas of pleasure, of leisure. But he found that it was empty. So then he went down another route. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. He went down that road of labor. Let's get to work. Let's build something. Let's accomplish something. I'm a little bit surprised that he doesn't mention the temple here. He built the temple that his father David longed to build. And Solomon spared no expense. If you ever get a chance, I think it's 1 Kings, maybe around chapter 6 or 8, right around there. Read what went into the temple. Gold, marble, cedar, the greatest elements they had at that time. And he spared no expense. And the temple in Jerusalem was a wonder. And I'm sure that when that was completed and it was dedicated, he must have felt very good. He had accomplished something. But he found that even that feeling of accomplishment didn't last. He concludes by writing, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. Chasing after the wind, nothing was gained under the sun. Can't you almost hear him singing, I can't get no satisfaction? Everything he tried came up empty. And it wasn't that he tried and failed. Solomon was very successful in the world's eyes. Everything he set his mind to do, he did. He accomplished it. And even that left him empty. You say, how can that possibly be? But you know what's happening all around us. You can see people of all walks of life, and they may be very successful in what they do, and yet they're still empty. Somebody asked the multimillionaire John D. Rockefeller, how much money does it take to be really happy? And his answer was, a little bit more. Doesn't matter how much you have, you need a little bit more. And you can say that about success, you can say that about prestige, power, whatever it is. Life has been rendered meaningless. It is empty. Why? Because of sin. That's part of the problem of sin, and it affects every single one of us. I'd like to illustrate this morning how this works in our lives. And this is where that chart comes in that's in your bulletin. I'm a strong believer in giving credit where credit is due. You find that chart in this book. It is called Effective Biblical Counseling by Lawrence Crabb. This must have been one of his earlier books because now he goes by Larry. You may have heard him on Focus on the Family. He's actually a graduate of the UI. He's got his doctorate in counseling and psychology, committed Christian, and his books are very excellent. This was actually a textbook of mine in college, and probably had the most impact of anything that I studied in the areas of psychology and counseling. And this chart that I'm going to walk through with you this morning comes out of the pages of his book. The chart begins with a box in the upper center. It's called personal needs. That's where we begin. People have one basic personal need, which requires two kinds of input in order to be fulfilled. The most basic need is a sense of personal worth, an acceptance of oneself as a real, whole person. That is what Solomon was trying to find. That sense of wholeness, that sense that I am what I was created to be. Now, we know that's been marred by sin. But those needs, or that need, is primary in our lives. Now, the two essential qualities that will meet that basic need, and I'll come up back to this time and time again, are significance and security. We need to feel significant. We need to feel there's a purpose, a meaning to life. We need to feel that we matter. And we also need security. That comes from love, unconditional, consistently expressed, permanent acceptance. These are the things every human being longs for. We want to matter, and we want to be loved and accepted. Now, Dr. Crabb writes, "My experience suggests that although men and women need both of these, the primary route for men to personal worth is significance. Their life has to matter. Whereas the primary route for women is security. They find it in their relationships." Now, I'm not saying that there aren't exceptions to that rule, and in fact, we do need both, but you will find men tend to seek it in what they do. Women tend to seek it in who they are and who they relate to. Not saying one's better than the other. That's just the way we're wired. That's how we act. Now, I believe that before the fall, Adam and Eve enjoyed significance and security. They knew why they were there. They were to have fellowship with God. They were to take care of His creation, and they were doing that. There was that satisfaction that they were fulfilling the very purpose God had given them when they were created. There was the security of knowing that they were in fellowship with God. He would come and walk with them in the garden. But all of that changed with sin. What was the first reaction of Adam and Eve after they sinned when they heard God coming? They were scared. They hid from God. Why? Because they were insecure. All of a sudden, they were insecure about themselves. They looked at each other and said, "You don't have any clothes on." "Oh, I don't either." And they hid. And mankind has been plagued with insecurity ever since. And when the curse of sin was pronounced, do you notice how men feel the curse of sin in their work, in their significance? The ground was cursed, and through the sweat of their brow, they would have to toil. They'd have to fight against the creation rather than with it. And then for women, it's their relationships. The relationship with the husband has been affected. the relationship with children and giving birth. That's what sin does. Sin has taken away our sense of security and significance, and we have been trying to get those back ever since. Every human being that is born with these basic needs unmet. And the tragedy of life is that so many find all of these different routes to try to fill these needs, and they come up empty. Why? Because they're doing it all under the sun. They're doing it without God. They're trying to make it on their own. They're trying to build security and significance into their lives through things that can't satisfy, just like Solomon had done in Ecclesiastes. Now, you'll notice that our basic needs are primarily emotions. We need to feel secure. We need to feel significant. And I believe that's because there's a God-shaped vacuum inside of each one of us. We'll get back to that at the end of our message. So, from these personal needs which are unmet, these essential qualities that we don't have in our lives, we begin what I'm calling the endless quest. We are trying to meet these needs. Now, I'll give you a spoiler alert. Security and significance only come through a relationship with Jesus Christ. It's the only way you're going to find these two needs in your life being met. But what a Solomon experienced in Ecclesiastes, what I'm illustrating today, is the attempts of mankind to fill those needs on his own. Now, the first step of the process is motivation. Motivation is the force that prompts us to do something. It's what gets us out of bed in the morning. It's what propels us to do whatever it is that we do. And this motivation begins in the mind. Motivation is the drive, that urge to meet my needs. And we're willing to expend energy in order to do it. So we begin with this motivation. What is my motivation? I need to feel significant. I need to know that my life matters, that I matter. I need to be secure. I need to know that no matter what happens, I'm okay. That's our motivation. Now, from the motivation, we lead into basic assumptions. Now, these basic assumptions are how those needs are going to be met. This is what we tell ourselves at the very beginning. In order to be significant, I need to have lots of money. I need to excel in business or whatever it is that I'm involved in. I need to never fail or make a mistake. I need to know that my kids turned out well. That way I am significant. That means my purpose in life has been satisfied. Or we might say, I will be secure if I have a loving spouse, if my children love me, if I'm never criticized, if everyone accepts me. These basic assumptions are what we tell ourselves will meet those basic needs. And this does begin in the mind. And that's very important because that is also the key to fixing the problem. What we need to understand is that wrong patterns of living develop from wrong philosophies of living. Before there's an action, there's a thought. Before a word comes out of our mouth, there's a thought. Usually. Sometimes we talk without thinking, but honestly, it does begin with a thought. We may not think it through very well, but there's a thought there. The Bible says in Proverbs 23:7, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. The mind is crucial in that it sets the whole ball rolling. It begins in the mind. Now, once a person latches onto a basic assumption that he or she believes will meet their need, their motivation requires a goal. A goal is set. A goal is a specific objective based on that assumption. If I want everybody to like me, then my goal is to never offend anyone, to make everybody happy. There are people who live their lives that way. If my goal is to succeed, then I maybe want to be the top of my class, or I want to be the CEO of the company, or maybe start my own business and have it be the best of all the businesses around. That's my goal. And from that goal, we have goal-oriented behavior. In order to achieve that goal, this is the steps I need to do. And here we begin the pursuit. We begin the chase, you might say. I'm going after my goal. Now, this is all well and good. There's nothing wrong with setting goals, setting objectives. Somebody after this morning's message in Moroa said they had been told that there's three things you should always ask about a goal. Is it attainable? Is it measurable? And is it reachable? Is it reasonable? And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not suggesting we should not have goals. The problem is, if our goal is wrong, then everything we do to reach that goal is going to be, everything's going to be tainted. Now, goal-oriented behavior can be intelligent, it can be realistic, it can be sensible, but it can also be ignorant, unrealistic, and utterly ineffective. And we'll see how that can lead to problems later on. This brings us to what I'm calling the eventual quandary, the dilemma of one who tries to find security and significance, and it manifests itself in a few different ways. First, you'll notice going toward the goal, there's a box there. There's a block. There's an obstacle. Things get in the way. I have it set in my mind that if I can accomplish this goal, if I can achieve this desire, then I'm truly going to be secure and significant. Something gets in the way. Something keeps us from reaching that goal. It might be that the goal itself was unreachable. I had mentioned someone who thought, to be significant, I need to never make a mistake. Good luck with that one, right? I mean, we're all going to make mistakes along the way. We're going to blow it at times. It's unreachable. I want everybody to like me. It's not going to happen. I don't ever want to upset anybody. You know how you not upset anybody? Lock yourself in your house and never come out. Don't talk to anybody. Don't interact with anybody. Just be a hermit. And even then, you'll probably upset somebody. It's totally unreachable. The problem is, we have convinced ourselves in our minds that it is reachable. It's something we should be able to do, and when we don't, it produces guilt. Oh, I should have tried harder. Oh, I should have done this differently. Oh, I blew it, and now I feel guilty. Maybe it was external circumstances, something outside of your control. Which, by the way, is a fourth question I would add to those questions about goals. If I set a goal, but it's dependent upon somebody else doing something for it to happen, that's not a good goal. You're setting yourself up for frustration. But a lot of times, other people or other events that are outside of our control, they keep us from our goal. We wanted that corner office of the CEO, but along the way, we got passed over by a promotion with somebody that should not have gotten it ahead of us. I mean, we earned that. What does that produce? Resentment. I resent whoever it was that got in my way. I resent whatever happened outside of my control. Maybe it was an injury that kept me from fulfilling this goal. You say, well, who are you mad at then? I mean, unless a person did that to you, sometimes it just happens. We resent God. How could you let this happen, God? And we live in resentment. Some people have a fear of failure. They're so afraid of failing because it'd make them look stupid, make them look foolish, that they don't even try. They're so anxious. They're so nervous. They worry about it so much, they sabotage their own success. I remember going through this when I was a teenager. It was real popular back then to go roller skating. A lot of the kids loved to go roller skating. And they'd say, hey, come on, let's go roller skating. I'm like, no way. Why? Because I don't know how to roller skate, and I'm not going to fall on my face in front of everybody and they laugh at me. I never put on a pair of roller skates and never will. Fear of failure, so you don't even try. These can get in the way. Now, I won't go into detail like he does in his book, but Dr. Crabb shows how people that get into these obstacles that keep them from their goals, if they don't double down and just try harder and overcome them, they can go all the way into neuroses. You can become neurotic. And what happens is you are trying to salvage whatever little bit of self-worth you have. And since you can't reach your goal, you kind of escape reality. It can get that serious right here. Now, we're Americans, and so, you know, if at first you don't succeed, try again. So we get over that obstacle. We meet that goal. Or at least we're on our way to meeting that goal. We get past these initial things. What happens? Well, we may get to the end of our journey and the goal is never met. I may have wanted to be a professional basketball player. Look at me. It ain't gonna happen. And I get to the end and nope, it's not gonna happen. A few weeks ago, we were watching, I believe it was figure skating, leading up to the Olympics. Think of the Olympics. How many athletes spend literally years of their lives, some of them sacrifice their childhood practically, because they're training and building up muscle and doing these things so they can make the Olympic team. How would you like to have come in fourth when they only take three? And maybe this is your last chance. And you are so sure that if you could meet this goal, you would find that happiness. Life would be meaningful, it'd be fulfilling. And the goal slips through your fingers. Oftentimes that leads to despair. Despair is another word for hopelessness. We feel there's no hope. There's no chance that I have of ever feeling like my life matters. There's no hope of ever having my life feel secure. And in extreme cases, could lead to suicide. Why? Because they've tried so hard to do what they convinced themselves would make their lives meaningful, and they failed. And now there's nothing left to live for. Now you also have those who meet their goals. They arrive. They made it. They achieved their goal. And there is some satisfaction. Did you hear that in Solomon's writings? You know, I gained pleasure in what I had built, what I did with my hands, and yet it's empty. Why? Because the thrill never lasts. The thrill of victory is very temporary. And it's only partial. It doesn't fully meet our need. Ravi Zacharias observes, what seems so difficult for many to grasp is that pleasure is always momentary. You can time it on every occasion. It has no staying power. That's what happens under the sun, apart from God. All pleasure, however good, is locked into the sensation of the moment. Later on today, there's going to be two groups of men that compete on a playing field for the highest prize in their sport. And one of those teams is going to come away victorious. They're going to meet that goal of winning a Super Bowl. And there will be joyous celebrations, and if it is who I think it's going to be that wins, you might even see their head coach crack a smile, maybe. But I guarantee you that if that team wins, tomorrow morning that coach is going to be saying, we're looking to next year. You celebrate it for a moment, then it's gone. As soon as you get the confetti out of your hair, you're on to the next thing. Why? Because it doesn't last. It doesn't truly satisfy. Solomon discovered that you can have power, wealth, wisdom, opportunity, all the things the world calls success. But if you don't have God, life doesn't satisfy. It doesn't even make sense. Horizontal happiness doesn't last. And that's why Solomon's Journal of Ecclesiastes is so relevant for today. People are still living this. They're still racing in trivial pursuits, trying to fill these holes in their lives, and it's not working. You can change the names, the geography, the year, the culture. You've still got Ecclesiastes being played out in living color. It only intensifies the further you go into his journal. And it brings us right back to where we started. You see how from vague emptiness, you go right back to your personal needs. You come back to the point of saying, you know what, I still need security and significance. I'm still searching. I'm still looking for it, and I haven't found it. Those who are ambitious may start over again. They change their basic assumptions, and they set new goals, and they go at it. Others just go get drunk or high to escape the pain. Some even take their lives. Bottom line is this: nothing ultimately brings satisfaction if it is limited to life under the sun. When you do not have God in the center of your life, if you do not find your meaning, your significance in life, in the fact that you were created in the image of God, that He created you on purpose, He has a purpose for your life, nothing else is going to meet that need. And when it comes to security and feeling unconditionally loved, you will not find that here on earth. And the closest you ever will find that will still be in an imperfect vessel. You might have someone that loves you unconditionally as much as a human can, but they may suddenly be taken out of your life. Where are you now? Only in God do we find significance and security that cannot be taken away. And it's the only way life will be satisfied. And so you see, so many people in life, just like Solomon, trying to find it in other things, and they wind up on a dead-end street called emptiness. Maybe you find yourself there. Maybe you're trying to fill that need with something other than what will fill that need. The good life, the life that truly satisfies, exists only when we stop wanting a better one. That's where that word content comes into play. See, Solomon was always after something bigger and something better and something newer and something more exciting. Sounds like commercials on TV, doesn't it? I think capitalism is based on discontent Because if everybody was happy with what they had, who would go to the store and buy more? But we're trying to meet a need with things that don't satisfy. And we think if I just have more, it'll make me happy. No, it won't. If people will love me and accept me, and if I can have my kids love me, or if I can have my spouse love me unconditionally, I'll be secure. No, you won't. Because they can't fill that need inside you. Only God can. The itch for things, the lust for more, it's a virus draining our souls of contentment. Have you noticed a man never earns enough? A woman is never beautiful enough. Clothes are never fashionable enough. Cars are never nice enough. Gadgets are never modern enough. Houses are never furnished enough. Food is never fancy enough. Relationships are never romantic enough. Life is never full enough. Why? Because we're leaving out God. Only God can satisfy. Regardless of how much you own, how much you experience, how much power, prestige, fame you might have, there's always that craving for more. Why? Because there's an empty spot in our lives that only God can fill. That's that God-shaped vacuum in every one of us that we try to fill with other things, and it doesn't work. Only God can meet those needs. The psalmist writes, "Delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart." I've heard some people twist that scripture into saying, well, you go to God, and He's got to give you anything you want. No. I believe what that verse is saying is when you delight yourself in the Lord, meaning you're in a place where God is pleased with you, He will put His desires in your heart so that you will want what He wants for you. That's a fulfilled life. When you want what God wants and then God provides it, what are you lacking? That is the way to fulfillment. Now, it's my hope that as we've gone through that diagram, maybe you've seen yourself somewhere along the way. Maybe you're angry and resentful and you're not really sure why. Maybe your life is filled with worry and fear. Maybe you're in the depths of despair. Maybe you've accomplished what you set out to, and yet they're just kind of empty. You see how all that happens in a life without God. Or maybe you'll be able to share this with somebody you know. Maybe they're in the midst of this cycle. They're somewhere along the line, and you can see, wow, that's right where they are. And you can share with them, you know, you're looking for something to satisfy in things that won't. Let me introduce you to the one who will. Because the only way to find a meaningful life is to be connected to the author of life. And that only comes through Jesus Christ. Millions and millions of people in our world are on an endless quest. They're searching to fill that hole in their soul. And eventually, they'll get to that dilemma that everything they've tried doesn't work. That's when we can share with them Jesus. Jesus truly satisfies, even more than Snickers does. You eat a Snickers bar, you're still going to get hungry again. When you come to Jesus, life is worthwhile.